Hezbollah chief says the expulsion of all U.S. troops from West Asia will be the ultimate revenge for the assassination of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. The Yemeni army says the Emirati-flagged vessel that it seized off the port of Hodeida was carrying military equipment and engaged in hostile acts. And gunmen fail in their bid to take the life of the Haitian Prime Minister months after President Moïse was assassinated at his home. Thanks for joining us. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi calls for the trial of former U.S. President Donald Trump as the main culprit for ordering the assassination of Iran's top military commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, back in 2020.
The then U.S. President must be put on trial as an aggressor, murderer, and the main criminal. He must face divine retribution. If Trump, Pompeo, and other criminals are not tried in a fair court for their horrible crime and are not punished for their shameful acts, I tell all American statesmen, do not doubt, Muslims will take revenge.
The Iranian president made the remark during a ceremony in Tehran to mark the second anniversary of the assassination of General Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Raisi said that if Trump and former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo are not tried in a fair court for Soleimani's assassination, Muslims will take revenge. Similar ceremonies were also held in other parts of the world, including in Yemen, Lebanon, the Gaza Strip, and Nigeria.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah lashed out at the United States as the mother of corruption and terrorism in the region and stressed that the expulsion of U.S. forces from the region will be the final revenge for the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit's commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad in 2020.
We have declared earlier that the best revenge is the full withdrawal of U.S. troops from the region. And over the past 2 years, as the leader Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, the U.S. has been forced to leave Afghanistan with humiliation. This has led the U.S. allies to rethink their alliance with Washington.
In an address to a ceremony in Beirut remembering the martyrs Qasem Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, and their companions, Sayyid Nasrallah also accused the U.S. of being behind all Israeli and Saudi crimes in the region for decades.
The lesson which I would like to highlight today is that everyone acting for the sake of God emerges victorious in all battles and wins the hearts and minds of all people across the Arab and Muslim worlds. They show us that the U.S. serves as the real enemy and source of corruption, occupation, and terrorism in our region.
Allies believe that the project of the resistance continues to face the criminality of the U.S. in Lebanon and the region.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani belonged to the school of thought of a struggle against the occupiers of our land and those who destroyed our homes and killed our people and led one war after the other with their support for the Zionists. He sacrificed his life and stood against terrorism in Iraq, Yemen, Syria, and Lebanon and Palestine. He taught us that Lebanon is strong enough and can remove itself from the U.S. hegemony.
The leader of the resistance stressed that the assassination of martyr Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, has triggered a new phase at the regional level.
The assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and PMU Commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis is seen as an incident larger than the region itself, and for many analysts has brought to light a long-term confrontation for Lebanon's Hezbollah facing U.S. influence in Lebanon and the region. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Brian Berletich is a writer and political analyst who joins us from Bangkok. Brian, welcome. When you take a look at what has happened in terms of the assassination, obviously against international law, targeted killing or extrajudicial killing, as some have called it, is something that is purely against international law. Why did the U.S. make such a decision with the help of Israel to take out what was known as an anti-terror icon in the name of Haj Qasem Soleimani?
Well, this is another example of the United States doing whatever it feels like, regardless of international law. They do this often in regards to everything. Their invasion and occupation of Iraq in the first place, which caused all of this instability, this was a blatant violation of international law. And this is how they exercise their power over the world. This is how they overwrite and override international law by just doing anything that they want. And as their power wanes around the globe, they do more and more extreme things to try to kind of coerce the world into going along with their version of an international order, which is entirely separate from something underwritten by actual international law.
Another thing that's very astounding in a sense, and shocking, I should say, is the fact that how they are portraying this icon that fought against Daesh terrorists to eliminate it as to be a bad guy, so to speak. And it's quite telling that the U.S. at some points actually supported terrorists like the ones in Syria, where you had the CIA program to the tune of $1 billion trying to get a training program going, where it failed in removing the democratically elected president of Assad at that point. Is that what the U.S. media or Western media is doing, and why would they want to do that to somebody who fought these terrorists?
It's actually very interesting, because the Western media, as you have said, this is how they generally portray this entire chain of events. But also, you will see where they have admitted in the past that General Soleimani and Iran in general has helped support the governments in Syria and Iraq overcome these extremely violent, extremely dangerous terrorist organizations. Terrorist organizations, the United States itself claims that it's in the region trying to fight, but obviously actually sponsoring. It's kind of a case where the U.S. is out breaking windshields at night and then opening a windshield repair shop at day. It's a very toxic, it's a very malicious foreign policy, and the media plays a very key role in misleading the general public as to what's actually going on. So it's very interesting how most of the time they try to portray Iran's role and General Soleimani's role as somehow negative, when in actuality they were key in stabilizing the region, a region the U.S. was trying to burn to the ground, and still to this day is.
And finally, quickly, do you really think that the U.S. and Israel thought this through when they decided to go ahead with this assassination of these two highly revered figures? Because the reason why I ask that is because the backlash that came, even within the ranks of the military in the U.S., they were not sure how there's going to be blowback on this. And the blowback comes in the form where you have the United States, and then in particular Israel, endangering their national security, because there's so many people that are now out to get them, so to speak. They saw these two figures as a special Qasem Soleimani to fight terrorists and to save the country, like the people of Iraq. Do you think that the U.S. and Israel therefore really thought this through?
I think that they did, but as an act of desperation, because their time of controlling the Middle East and sowing death and destruction and above all division, these days are coming to an end. And this is why they're doing things that are incredibly desperate, incredibly dangerous, not just to the stability of the region, but to their own long-term self-interest and self-preservation. They're not thinking about that because of this short-term desperation they have to keep a grip on a region that they had controlled and manipulated for decades and decades. This is all coming to an end. So they have done this. I believe there is a very large threat of them doing something else, also incredibly dangerous. And just like you said, it's not even just the immediate blowback from the people who are directly upset about this. It's the fact that, yes, everyone in Syria and Iraq know who is actually helping them and who is not. And by doing this, U.S. just the mask just slips further down. The rest of the world can see what the U.S. is really doing, no matter how its powerful media tries to portray otherwise.
Pleasure. Thank you so much, Brian Berletesh, writer and political analyst from Bangkok. Many thanks. On to Yemen, Yemen's army releases footage of an Emirati-flagged vessel seized Monday off the country's western port city of Hodeidah. The army spokesman says the ship, which was carrying military equipment, has been taken to Salif port. Yahya Sari says the vessel was engaged in hostile acts against Yemen's security and stability. According to the media, the ship was heading to the Saudi port of Jizan in the Red Sea. They claimed that it was carrying equipment from a shuttered field hospital. We have reached out to activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Baqaiti for comments. He explains how the seizure of the vessel has taken the war on Yemen to a new stage.
They know that the Yemeni army, they have taken the ship because it was sailing inside Yemen international water. And as well, just let's make one thing clear, if the ship was not in Yemen international water, because it's a military ship used by the Saudi armed force and the United Arab Emirates armed force, that's why Yemeni army have the right to seize this ship anywhere. And I think that this is a new blow to Saudi coalition war on Yemen, because I believe that with this new action taken by Yemeni army and taking this ship, we have started a new stage of the war. Now Yemeni army can conduct attack against Saudi armed ships inside the Red Sea or anywhere, and as well they can conduct air attack against Saudi Arabia and land attack, and as well attacking Saudi ports. And I believe that if the Saudi will not stop its war against Yemen, we're going to see more of this type of this attack to secure Yemen international water from the Saudi forces.
The Palestinian Commission for Prisoners is renewing warnings over the deteriorating health condition of an inmate who has been on a hunger strike for months. The warning comes after medical experts said that Hisham Abu Hawash is in danger of sudden death or a stroke. He went on a hunger strike more than 140 days ago to protest his illegal administrative detention by the Israeli regime. Currently, he is in a state of coma. Palestinian officials say Israel's refusal to free Abu Hawash is clear evidence that the regime is deliberately leaving him to die. They say the silence of the international community and human rights organizations shows their complicity in this crime. Abu Hawash is one of hundreds of Palestinian inmates languishing in Israeli jails without charge or trial.
After almost 140 days of his hunger strike, the 40-year-old Palestinian prisoner Hisham Abu Hawash is in imminent danger, facing the risk of sudden death at any moment. Representatives of Palestinian factions and prisoners' advocacy groups in the occupied Ramallah took to the streets again, sounding the alarm over the health condition of Abu Hawash, who is protesting his illegal administrative detention without charge or trial.
My brother Hisham could die at any moment. This is according to medical reports by the doctors who have directly examined Hisham. We are really worried about his health. Israel is using a new form of assassination against our brothers.
The International Committee of the Red Cross has meanwhile issued a statement demanding Israel to immediately release Abu Hawash. Israel claims it keeps some Palestinians behind bars without disclosing sensitive information that could expose valuable sources. In the case of Abu Hawash, Israeli intelligence claims he is an activist of the jihad movement. However, it was not able to provide explicit evidence in support of its allegations. Palestinian human rights organizations say it's yet another attempt to bring Palestinian prisoners to their knees and prevent them from being engaged in any form of struggle.
My brother Hisham could die at any moment. This is according to medical reports by the doctors who have directly examined him. We are really worried about his health. Israel is using a new form of assassination against our brothers.
Last month, the Israeli regime accepted to release hunger-striking prisoner Kaid al-Fasfus after 131 days of his protest, where his release was seen as yet another form of victory. As Israel reportedly holds over 4,500 Palestinian prisoners, hundreds of them are languishing behind bars without charge or trial under the illegal so-called administrative detention. Palestinians pray that Abu Hawash's life could be saved before it's too late. Abu Hawash, who's literally on the verge of death, has said before his health severely deteriorated that he will continue his hunger strike until victory. That is, according to him, his release or his martyrdom. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Haiti's prime minister is safe and sound following an attempt on his life that took place over the weekend. The prime minister's office says bandits and terrorists tried to shoot Ariel Henry during ceremonies to mark the anniversary of the nation's independence at a church in the northern city of Gonaives. Footage circulating on social media shows Henry running for cover toward his car as gunmen begin shooting just outside the venue. One person is dead and two others have been injured. Haiti's former president, Jovenel Moïse, was shot dead inside his home 5 months ago. A group of Colombian mercenaries trained in the U.S. were among the suspects arrested. A local gang had threatened Henry in media just ahead of the incident. His office says that arrest warrants have been issued in the case. Coronavirus cases are seeing an uptick in India. The world's second most populous country is reporting over 37,000 daily infections. That is the highest figure since early September, and is six times higher than a week ago. The Omicron variant is overtaking Delta in the majority of states, including in the capital, New Delhi. A weekend curfew will come into force in the megacity to curb the spread of the strain. The surge has also prompted authorities in other states to bring back restrictions. Nearly 1,900 people have so far been diagnosed with Omicron. And in neighboring China, the central city of Yuzhou has gone into a lockdown affecting 1 million residents over the detection of just 3 cases. New infections have recently increased in China, reaching highs not seen since March 2020. And that is it for this edition of World News.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today we are going to discuss Imam Khomeini's views on armed forces and his recommendations on the issue which he has dealt with in his testament. Stay tuned, please. Armed forces are among the most important bases of security and stability of countries, as they are in the first to confront any foreign aggression and threat against public security. Formation of an army in the modern shape in Iran dates back to some two centuries. The formation of armed forces has undergone ups and downs, but during the Pahlavi rule, Iran's army became one of the equipped armies in the region, and in the second half of the 20th century, it was considered as the most powerful armies in the region and the world, thanks to the oil money that was generously spent to purchase American weapons and ammunition. In view of this, Iran's army turned into the gendarme of the region. Upon the fall of the Shah in February 1979, the Iranian army weakened for a short while. But with Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist army's attack on Iran in 1980, the Islamic Republic revised its armed forces and succeeded to prevent Saddam's expansionism and safeguard the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. The eight-year imposed war proved the high status of armed forces for the country. Hence, for the past three decades after the war, reinforcement of the armed forces has been one of the most important priorities of the Islamic Republic. This has its roots in the Islamic ideology. God says in Ayah 60 of Surah Anfal, "Prepare against them whatever you can of power." Imam Ali, peace upon him, writes in his famous letter to his top commander, Malik Ashtar, "The soldiers are the fortresses of people, the ornament of rulers, the dignity of religion and the ways of security, and people will not last long except by them." The formation and strengthening of armed forces have been emphasized in the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Accordingly, Iran's armed forces are divided into military and law enforcement forces with separate duties for each of them. The military forces consist of the Army and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC. According to Iran's constitution, the Army is duty-bound to maintain the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the country, while the IRGC's duty is to maintain the Islamic Revolution and its achievements. The Constitution emphatically prohibits the membership of foreigners in the armed forces. Furthermore, establishment of any foreign base is forbidden in the Iranian soil, even for peaceful purposes. The leader of the Islamic Revolution is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. According to the importance of the armed forces in the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, dedicated parts of his testament to the issue. He writes, "The armed forces, including the army, the IRGC, police, committees, and Basij, have a special characteristics. These forces, which are the strong arms of the Islamic Republic and the guardians of borders, ways, cities, villages, and finally the guards of security and comforters of the nation, should be paid a special attention by the nation, the government, and the parliament." Imam Khomeini warns against the role of big powers to make use of military forces in different countries for regime change and staging of coup d'etats. He writes in his testament, "Take heed that what in this world is abused by big powers and their destructive policies are the armed forces, as through political games, coups and regime changes are done by them. And the deceitful profiteers bribe some of their leaders and, through them, and the deceived commanders, take the countries in their hands, subjugate oppressed nations, and deny independence and freedom of these countries. And if virtuous commanders take the helms of power, there will never be the possibility of a coup or occupation of a country. And if there is, it will be defeated and unsuccessful by devoted commanders." Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
As ceremonies are underway in Iran to mark the second anniversary of the U.S. assassination of the country's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas, the world is realizing more and more what this martyr stood for. Iran will never forget the U.S. and Israeli crimes in this assassination, and has urged the U.N. Security Council to hold both responsible for this crime. This edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the significance of martyr Soleimani and his impact on the world stage.
2 years on since the U.S.'s assassination of top Iranian military commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, made headlines, and Iranians still grieve his loss. On the second anniversary of the incident, thousands gathered at Tehran's Grand Mausoleum to pay tribute to him. Addressing the gathering, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi vowed to bring those behind the incident to justice.
If Trump and Pompeo are not tried in a fair court for the criminal act of assassinating Lieutenant Soleimani, Muslims will take our martyr's revenge.
General Soleimani was the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. He, together with commander of Iraq's popular mobilization units, Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas, was assassinated in January 2020 in a U.S. air raid outside Baghdad International Airport, on a direct order from then-U.S. President Donald Trump. Soleimani is well known for dismantling Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also spearheaded major operations in Syria that resulted in liberating key areas from Daesh. This made him rise to fame in the region as the mastermind of the fight against terrorism.
Lieutenant Soleimani did not allow the terrorists to approach our borders. We owe our security and stability to his sacrifices.
If it wasn't for Lieutenant General Soleimani, the entire region would have collapsed and fallen under Daesh control. Not only Iranians, but the people of the region are indebted to him.
The U.S. thought in vain that by assassinating Qasem Soleimani, it would stop his fight against terrorism. But in fact, the incident gave rise to a united front in the region against Washington, and that's what led to the humiliating ouster of American troops from the region.
Iran says it is seriously following up on its legal pursuit to prosecute those behind Soleimani's assassination. Iran and Iraq have recently formed a joint investigation committee, comprising judicial experts from both countries. Based on the latest findings of the legal team, more than 120 people have been identified in connection with Soleimani's assassination. Former U.S. President Donald Trump tops the list.
These people say by assassinating General Soleimani, the United States tried to disrupt the regional fight against terrorism, something which they say put Washington on a confrontational course with the countries in West Asia and marked the beginning of its exit from the region. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, joins us from Brussels. Also joining us, international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan, who joins us from London, Ontario.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back.
All right, I'd like to welcome you both. And I'd like to first start with you, Edward Corrigan. And the reason why I want to start with you is because I want you to set the stage and tell us the type of crime that has taken place here, or that took place, which led to the assassination of these two martyrs, General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Excuse me, because there might be some out there that have been told through various media outlets that this was justified in the words of the U.S., for example. But you tell us the legality of what took place, or the illegality, I should say, of what took place.
Well, in my view, it clearly is an illegal act. In fact, it's much more severe than just an extrajudicial execution, because General Soleimani was there at the invitation of the Iraqi government. It was an official diplomatic mission, and the Americans, assassinated him, but also the deputy leader of the Iraq Popular Mobilization Units, which ostensibly was an ally of the United States in the war against the Islamic State and Daesh. So it's even, politically and legally, this is much worse than just an assassination, which of course is terrible in itself. You're violating the sovereignty of Iraq, and the Iraqi parliament a few days later unanimously adopted a resolution calling for the removal of all American troops from Iraq. So this is, at a very, very high level, you're violating the diplomatic sovereignty of not only Iran, but also Iraq itself, which is, again, it's an ally of the United States. They're fighting the war against Daesh. But it really exposes the fact that the United States and its allies, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and at one time Qatar, were funding this Islamic State against Iraq and against Syria. And, these are our American allies.
Right.
There has been, I can't really think of another assassination, or very few assassinations that's high profile of this and have violated Islamic laws, but also are so politically stupid. The Americans think that they're above the law.
Right.
There's no accountability for them. They can say what they want. There's been no legitimate reason given that I have seen but for justify the assassination. They said, oh, it was a preemptive strike. Well, but this is premeditated murder.
Sure.
And, you cannot assassinate, one of the top leaders of Iran and also of Iraq at the same time.
Sure.
So, the arrogance of the Americans here is simply incredible. There should be action at the International Criminal Court, also the UN Security Council, but of course it deals with the veto. But they're also calling for the General Assembly, the United Nations, to issue a resolution to commemorate this horrific act and to maintain the memory of General Soleimani and, of course, how he led the fight against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. So
sure.
He is a very successful military commander, which is why I think the Americans want him dead.
Well, yeah, these actions should take place. We're going to get to that. But Elijah Magner, there's a line here that is very subtle, but yet it's huge in the implications, and that is the way that not only through media spin, Qasem Soleimani, martyr Qasem Soleimani, is painted not for the hero that he has been, including Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, but also the fact that it was the U.S.'s right, in which Israel also collaborated with the U.S. in its assassination, because they were not a force for the good, fighting the evil Daesh terrorists. And this is given media spin, and they're trying very hard, Western media, to portray a negative image of them. Do you think they were successful? And why is it that they're trying to, so to speak, cover up what they have created in some sense?
Thank you for having me. Of course they were not successful, because the Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mahdi at that time in January 2020 said that Qasem Soleimani was an envoy coming to Iraq to his invitation and to his call for two reasons. First, to mediate between the Americans and Iran, and second, a message between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Secondly, Brigadier General Qasem Soleimani was also an advisor to the Iraqi government, an official advisor, as recognized by Foreign Minister Ibrahim Jaafari at that time, who asked the support of Iran against ISIS to defeat the terrorist group. So he was an official envoy from a country to another country working against terrorism and counterterrorism. Now, after the assassination, and when Donald Trump left office, we heard how he was disappointed that Benjamin Netanyahu dragged him to assassinate General Soleimani and did not go to war against Iran. So it was obvious that he's acting, that Benjamin Netanyahu was acting as the advisor to Donald Trump, because Trump was completely incompetent and unaware of the consequences of committing such a crime in a non-lawful way against a sovereign country when the U.S. forces were not supposed to be combat troop in Iraq. Also, there is a big blame on Iraq on different aspects, because Soleimani was their guest and was working to support the Iraqi government and the Iraqi sovereignty, and to give back the territory that was taken by ISIS. And also, it is up to the Iraqi to defend their guest and their envoy, particularly when this person represents a country that was supporting Iraq for free. Also, it is also the responsibility of the Iraqi to expel the American, because they have violated the mandate they are in Iraq for. Secondly, they committed a crime without a consultation with the Iraqi government. Third, they implicated Iraq and Iran into a war on the Iraqi arena, where perhaps they thought Iran is not going to react, and they were disappointed by the Iranian reaction. And also, we saw the parliament that asking the Iraqi forces to leave, the U.S. forces to leave the country, and they did not abide by the parliament resolution with 173 MPs mm-hmm. who voted for this, for to expel all the U.S. forces from the country. So all that is obvious to all the observers and world leaders. So it is no longer possible to hide this crime and to yet add it, as your guest rightly said, to all the unlawful act of, and crime of the United States.
Sure. Well, people seem to forget, and they have a short memory when it comes down to it, Edward Corrigan. And I'd like to refresh, maybe your memory too, I'm sorry to say, but overall, because mine was refreshed, but more to the wider world, in terms of the support that these terrorists were given. There's no denying, there's a fact that Saudi Arabia was directly supporting the terrorist group Jabhat al-Nusra. There's no denying that Israel had been treated injured Daesh terrorists in the Golan Heights. The picture was there, former Prime Minister Netanyahu. There's no denying New York Times' $1 billion secret CIA war in Syria, which died and was trying to get these terrorists to fight against the democratically elected government of President Assad. So you have the U.S. involved, you have Saudis involved, Israel involved, and yet you have the ones that were fighting them, namely, in this case, Qasem Soleimani, martyred, to be assassinated. So where's the justice here?
Well, there's absolutely no justice. It's highly criminal. But it really exposes the role of the United States and its allies, Israel, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, in supporting Daesh and using the Islamic State as a way to destabilize the region and to do damage and to Iraqi society and to try to destroy Syria. You know, the former Qatar Prime Minister, publicly announced, said that, you know, that Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates were the main financial supporters behind the Islamic State. And while the Americans pretend to be fighting the Islamic State, a lot of the time they're bombing the Iraqis, Syrians, Hezbollah, even, Russian soldiers that were there at the invitation of the Syrian government. So there's, it really, it boggles the mind that they could do this and think that there was, little or no consequences they would have to face. And, this, around the world, you know, this is seen as a horrific crime, yet another example of American arrogance and, you know, use of violence and assassination to accomplish its political goals. But the American media, the Western media, is not really addressing the core issue, which is American support for Daesh, the creation of, you know, Al-Qaeda, and, you know, the funding and arming of Daesh and Islamic State by the United States and Israel, but also its lackeys, the Saudi Arabians, and, you know, United Arab Emirates. So, you know, this, they still say, oh, we're fighting Daesh, we're fighting the Islamic State. But when you look at the actions of the Americans, you know, who they bomb, who they kill, you know, it's, they have been providing, you know, military support, logistical support, communication support, you know, using satellites and everything else to help Daesh fight the democratic elected government of Syria, the democratic elected government of Iraq, and of course, you know, to try to destabilize the region. And, you know, this has cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of people and done untold damage. But even the Americans have spent $2 trillion on this war, and, you know, when the only thing accomplishment that they can count is that they helped destroy Syria and Iraq, and that is simply, you know, unconscionable.
Well, let's see what Iran's president has said on this occasion, Elijah Magnier, and I'm going to quote him. Two statements that he said: the aggressor and the main assassin, the then president of the U.S., must face justice and retribution. That if Trump and former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo are not tried in a fair court for Soleimani's assassination, Muslims will take revenge. What is your interpretation of what he has said?
Well, what Pompeo told us that he lies all the time. Therefore, we can't take anything he says for face value. Also, we see how Pompeo imposed sanctions on the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Therefore, it is an administration that rebuffed all the law that exists because they prevent any legal organization, even that was created by the U.S. itself, to condemn the American soldier for their act and the American administration for committed crimes overseas. So, as we all are very much aware today, that this U.S. administration, the previous one and the one before it, and throughout the years, always the administration did not respect any international law. Now, it is obvious that the Iraqis want to revenge their leader, Abu Mahdi Mohandes, and their guest, Qasem Soleimani, because they were killed in Iraq. And it is up to them to react for this killing and to make sure that the responsible who bragged about it and announced their responsibility will pay the heavy price equivalent to the value of these two commanders, which is a lot. I mean, we're talking about the people who are responsible, who were responsible for defeating ISIS and liberating Iraq and Syria and part of Lebanon for the support that Soleimani offered to the act of the resistance to free these three countries from the terrorist organization that General Mike Flynn told his boss, Barack Obama, at that time, that ISIS was growing in Iraq and going to go to Syria, and America decided to close both eyes on this fact.
Indeed. Well, one thing that is in line with what Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has said, Edward Corrigan, is what Iran's leader actually said, in a sense, it parallels that, in which he said Martyr Soleimani is more dangerous to the enemy than General Soleimani, because the likes of Soleimani will rise in the future. I mean, if you think about what is said there, it poses the question then that this assassination, this targeted killing, as you said, the extrajudicial killing that took place, didn't it in turn jeopardize the national security of Israel in particular in this region, since it was complicit in what the U.S. decided to do, which then in a sense mirrors other acts that the U.S. has done in other countries, where it comes back to haunt it?
Well, they think that they're above the law and that they're unaccountable and nobody can touch them. In Israel, there was a book published, I guess, a little over a year ago, which documents 2,000 assassinations that the Mossad conducted. And this is, you know, this is staggering that, you know, that a country would go running around assassinating 2,000 people. The United States has also, and through the CIA and other intelligence agencies, has been involved with numerous assassinations, coups, overthrowing of the government. And, you know, none of this is discussed in the mainstream press in the United States or even Canada, and to a lesser extent in Western Europe. So, you know, there's this, you know, selective blindness, I guess the legal term would be, and a cover-up of all this criminality. But, you know, the, you know, United States was funding an army and supporting Daesh and the Islamic State against the sovereign countries in the Middle East and using it as a way of destabilizing these countries, which is, you know, a very, you know, vicious agenda, but ultimately doesn't work. It just creates people, you know, hate and resentment from the peoples of the region. You know, the Iraqi parliament unanimously, you know, called for the removal of U.S. troops, and the American, actually the generals said, okay, we'll leave, but then the Americans backtracked on that, and they still haven't left Iraq. So, you know, they're there in flagrant violation mm-hmm. of Iraq's sovereignty, and also at the wishes of the Iraqi government and the Iraqi people.
Sure.
And, you know, this is you know, it's really crazy thinking that they think they get away with this, and this somehow is going to help their security interests or Israel's security interests. It's not. It makes things much worse.
Well, U.S. President Elijah McNair, in conclusion, has said that the most pressing issue for Marshal Soleimani was how to repel the enemy from the region and liberate the region. Do you think that this region will be liberated from, for example, the U.S. and the destruction that it has caused?
Qasem Soleimani is a man who represent an ideology, a mission, a task, and he represent the country. So it is in the constitution of Iran, in its Article 132, to support the oppressed population in the world. The oppressed population have been supported by Iran, and Iran is supporting people who want to liberate their country. Therefore, the assassination of Qasem Soleimani created a school where there are thousands of other Qasem Soleimani who will walk on the same path to support the population who want to liberate their country from the oppressor and the occupation. This is happening in Gaza, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, in Venezuela, and any country who wants to push away the US hegemony and the unlawful act of the Americans. So yes, this is a school. The death of Qasem Soleimani is just one event, and there are thousands of others who will continue the same work of Soleimani.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight, and we thank our guest Elijah McNair from Brussels, journalist and political analyst. Thank you. And thank you, Edward Corrigan, an international human rights lawyer who spoke to us from London, Ontario. And we thank you, Fumiko Vitapa, the entire team. It's goodbye until next time.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Hello and welcome to another session of Q&A on Islamic belief. This is IRIB English Radio and I'm your host. We're going to discuss the animal rights. This is the following session of the two previous sessions. In this session, we're going to discuss about the right of living of the animals. Hello, Dr. Karimi.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. Is it true that Fatima Zahra forgave Abu Bakr in her late days?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. All Shia and Sunni scholars agree that after the demise of our Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, some issues happened between the beloved daughter of our Holy Prophet, Fatimah Zahra, salamullahi alayha, and the first two caliphs, I mean Abu Bakr and Umar, and she was angry with them. For example, we know the fact that the right of Imam Ali alayhi salam for successor, she was usurped from him. We know the story of Fadak and the fact that it was taken from Fatimah Zahra, salamullahi alayha. And she explicitly mentioned in different occasions that I'm angry with you, referring to the first two caliphs. And it is mentioned in both Shia and Sunni sources. Now, some of our Sunni brothers, they believe that this is true. I mean, she became angry with them. But later in her life, in the last days of her life, she became happy and somehow she forgave especially the first caliph, and it is because of a narration mentioned by one of the Sunni scholars, Bayhaqi, in Dalail al-Nubuwa, volume 7, page 281. Let me share this narration because we need to analyze this narration.
Yes.
The narrator of this narration is a person called Sha'bi. He says that when Fatimah Zahra, salamullahi alayha, she became ill, Ataha Abu Bakr al-Siddiq, the first caliph, went to her to visit her. فَاسْتَأْذَنَ عَلَيْهَا, she asked for permission to go and visit her. قَالَ عَلِيٌّ يَا فَاطِمَ هَذَا أَبُو بَكْرِ يَسْتَأْذَنُ عَلَيْكَ. Imam Ali alayhi salam, addressing his wife, said that, O Fatima, this is the first caliph, and he's asking me to give him permission to come to you. أَتُحِبُّ أَنْ أَذَنَ, do you like me to
give him permission?
Give him permission. And according to this narration, Lady Zahra salamun alayha said yes. So he came in and yataraddaha, he asked her for to forgive him. So first of all, it has a great message that he has done something wrong. That
yes.
is why he is asking for
forgiveness.
So I mean, even though the scholars who are resorting to this narration, they should accept that before that he has done something wrong, and that is why right now he's asking for forgiveness. Now, according to this narration, the first caliph continued saying that, "I swear by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that I didn't leave my family and my properties and my kings and folk unless to, but for the pleasure of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the Prophet and you, the family of the Prophet. So I ask you to forgive me." And the narration ends with saying that Hatta radiyat. So according to this narration, she became happy. I mean, she forgave the first caliph. So this is the narration. Now we need to analyze this narration and to share some other points to come to this conclusion whether this is a true claim or not. The first point is that first of all, we need to examine the chain of the narration, and this is done by all the Muslim scholars, whether Shia or Sunni. The chain of the narration is technically speaking mursal. Not all the names of the narrators are mentioned. Sha'bi is not a companion of the Prophet. He is one of the tabi'un, meaning that those people who saw the companions but not the Prophet. So they were the generation after the Sahaba, yes. The companions. But he himself is quoting this event. He is not able to see the event. He needs to quote it from another person. But the chain is not complete. We call this narration, technically speaking, a mursal narration, which means that it's not authentic at all.
Yes.
This is the first point. The second point is that Sha'bi, according to both Shia and Sunni sources, he is one of the great enemies of Imam Ali alayhi salam. He's kind of, Nasibi. It's been mentioned in some of the Sunni sources, for example, Ansab al-Ashraf by Baladari, volume 4, page 315, that the same Sha'bi mentions that we went to Basra, we saw some people insulting Imam Ali alayhi salam or Ali ibn Abi Talib, and we did the same. So this is the person who is narrating this story. A staunch enemy of the, yes, Ahlul Bayt and Imam Ali alayhi salam. So,
the reliability of the question has to be tested.
Of the narration, exactly. So not only the Shia, I believe that even the Sunnis may not rely on the narrations of this person,
yes,
because they, our Sunni brothers and sisters, they also love the Ahlul Bayt. They love the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. So this person is a person who himself says that I used to, insult Imam Ali alayhi salam. Referring to this point regarding the chain of the narration, gives us this conclusion that this narration is not authentic at all.
Yes.
And we have a bunch of evidence to prove that it is a forged narration, just somehow to purify the first caliph from that mistake.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
The next point is that there are many other narrations in most authentic Sunni collections of hadith which refer to the fact that Fatimah al-Zahra salamullah alayha was angry with the first caliph, and she was angry with them till her demise. She never forgave them. This,
yes,
is mentioned in the most authentic Sunni collections of hadith. So, for example, it's been mentioned by Bukhari in his Sahih, and we know that Sahih Bukhari is the most authentic collection.